Good morning, everybody. Nice to see you here in person, those of you who've gathered today. Welcome to those of you who are joining us online, whenever it is that you tune in, whether today or sometime later this week. We are wrapping up our 3 weeks on Exodus, and as you'll see this morning, we really should have had 7 or 8 weeks. We have a lot of plagues to get through today, you'll see we're gonna skip one, the kind of the last kind of Passover blood on the door, firstborn kind of thing. And we're gonna kind of focus in on some of the other ones in the Red Sea crossing, trusting that you know where to go to find it. And hint, and it's in the book of Exodus if you want to read that. And we'll see if we can squeeze it in on the side. But next week, just as a reminder, we've got a guest facilitator from Princeton Seminary named Heath Carter, Dr. Heath Carter, who is a historian of American Christianity, and he will be talking to us about just how Christians in this country historically have thought about making social change happen, and that reflects the values of the faith, and the hope that goes into that, and how people turn to the scriptures and find that hope. And so he knows this is kind of more Bible study-ish, and he's going to do a little bit of that, but he's gonna kind of spice it up a little bit. And so I hope you'll come back and get to know him. He's really fun and energetic, and he'll be here for the next 2 weeks, and then I'll kind of wrap up on the third week. Yeah, this is a little funny sounding, isn't it?
All right. Oh, look at that. So much better. Yeah. All right. So for those of you who are just tuning in, let me give you a kind of quick recap of where we've been. Week one, we talked about, just kind of got the lay of the land. There's this cruel Pharaoh. He has enslaved the Israelites as they have grown and grown in population. He has stamped down on them all the harder, fearing some kind of maybe slave uprising, who knows. And we saw these kind of remarkable examples of resistance among all women. Not a lot of guys who really stepped up to the plate, but we saw women, Israelite women, Egyptian women, who saw that oppression was happening and took kind of dramatic and interesting steps to... what a morning. That could mean I got email, but, you know, who knows? I always am a little nervous when I use presentations, you know, because the text messages go to the computer, and I'm always afraid my partner is going to send like one of those heart eye emojis, and it's going to pop up on the screen in the middle of it. Okay. So anyway, women resisting. Last week we talked about how God was at work in Moses and in Pharaoh too. There's this kind of really interesting and challenging paradox of how human beings, we kind of make our own magic happen in the world, and how also God is kind of wrapped up in that, behind the scenes, in our hearts, just in the natural laws of the universe, sort of how God accomplishes God's will in the world, and how we kind of make our will happen, or how our wills get in the way of God's will. So that was a lot of fun. This week, we're going to be doing plagues and freedom, the getting out of Egypt. So a lot of plagues. So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of march through them. And I'll ask you in advance to kind of keep your eyes peeled for what feels different. There's a lot of similarities plague to plague. There's a lot of repetition in terms of, you know, let my people go, and these kind of familiar refrains. I've cut some of them up into littler pieces. But just kind of notice, how are they different? And who suffers as a result of these plagues? How do these plagues work themselves out in the story? And just anything else, we'll kind of do a brief after each plague. I'll kind of turn it back to you and say, what stuck out to you? What do you want to lift up? And so be ready to do that, and then we'll kind of march on for some kind of meaning-making at the end. So first plague, here we go. Exodus chapter 7. Before we do that, let me say, the story we did last week, what we ended with the rod turning into a snake, if you remember that story, kind of a sea dragon actually is the word for what the rod turned into when he throws it on the ground. Some people say that's the first plague, and how you number the plagues, it's all over the place. Some people say there are 9, some people say there are 10. If, you know, some people don't count the death of the firstborn at the end as a plague. Some people, you know, do or don't count the rod turning into a snake. But mostly, like, if you open your Bibles, it probably will have the heading, you know, the first plague on this one. So usually the tradition is kind of we start in here, and there are 9 plagues. So the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hardened. He refuses to let the people go. So go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to the water. Stand by at the riverbank to meet him, and take in your hand the staff that was turned into a snake. Say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you to say, let my people go, so that they may worship me in the wilderness. But until now you have not listened. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. See, with the staff that is in my hand, I will strike the water that is in the Nile, and it shall be turned to blood. The fish in the river shall die. The river itself shall stink, and the Egyptians shall be unable to drink water from the Nile. The Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over its rivers, its canals, and its ponds, and all its pools of water, so that they may become blood. And there shall be blood throughout the whole land of Egypt, even in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone. What's the vessels kind of at the end? What is that? What do you think that means? Yeah, water jars, bowls, everything sitting out, you know, something on a ledge, on a stoop, a well, everything turned to blood, not just the rivers. So Moses and Aaron, yeah, a lot of blood. Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord commanded. In the sight of Pharaoh and of his officials, he lifted up the staff and he struck the water in the river, and all the water in the river was turned into blood. And the fish in the river died. The river stank so that the Egyptians could not drink its water, and there was blood throughout the whole land of Egypt. But the magicians of Egypt did the same by their secret arts. So Pharaoh's heart remained hardened, and he would not listen to them as the Lord had said. Pharaoh turned and went into his house, and he did not take even this to heart. And all the Egyptians had to dig along the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink the water of the river. All right, so anything stick out to you? Anything just, yeah. And Mario's coming with a mic.
I've read this all the time, and I just didn't realize that the magicians did the same thing. And
yeah.
I'm trying to figure out, how could they do the same thing if all the blood, I mean, what did they do?
Create, yeah, exactly, right. Where did they get the water from if the water was already turned to blood, right? So there's this curious little, so the first thing to say about that is just kind of, in the story, you can see at the end, they kind of, when there's no more water anywhere, they're digging along the Nile, so maybe we're supposed to believe there are these kind of underwater aquifers or something, you know, these kind of cisterns beneath the ground, and the magicians had dug up some of that, and so the magic only worked, the miracle, the plague only worked above ground, you know, and in the subways you're safe. So maybe that's one way you could think about it at that very last line when they went digging. You know, the second thing to say about that is maybe, you know, with these plagues, you'll see there's kind of some of these logical inconsistencies with them. So if you take this with absolute kind of literalness, it's not going to work, right? We're going to see later on that, you know, one of the plagues is supposed to kill all the animals, and the next plague, the animals are back again, and you're sort of like, well, how does that work, you know? So there's something else happening in these stories, in the cumulative kind of force of plague after plague after plague, that we're not maybe supposed to see it as, you know, literally, factually true per se, right? There, whatever historical kernel is underneath of that, it's probably not the case that every last drop of water, you know, turned into blood, and every cow died in, you know, plague number whatever. So there's that kind of caution that something's happening here that's important and spiritually relevant for us, but what is it? Anything else stuck out to you? Yeah.
It doesn't say anything about whether, it just says the Egyptians shall be unable to drink water.
Yeah, now, okay.
Presumably the Israelites need to drink water also. Are yeah. they able to?
It doesn't. Yeah, great question. So later on in the plagues, they'll make specific mention that the Egyptian, they'll say the Israelites are living in this land called Goshen, and there's kind of like a barrier, a force field around their land, and they're totally, whatever's going on in Egypt, it's not harming them. So this story doesn't tell us that, but we can imagine, yeah, that they've got these, you know, they're protected. So anything else about plague number one? All right, well, one thing just to note is kind of this image of the waters turning to blood. Think about, I think this is kind of a wonderful foreshadowing of that Red Sea crossing, right? When the Egyptians are going to follow the Israelites in, they're all going to be drowned, and there's this kind of, you know, the sea turning into blood, right? There's, you know, kind of grim image, but this is, you know, I think it kind of an interesting setting us up for that. Let's see, plague number two, what do we got? All right. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go so that they may worship me. If you refuse to let them go, I will plague your whole country with frogs. The river shall swarm with frogs. They shall come up into your palace, into your bedchamber and your bed, and into the houses of your officials and of your people, and into your ovens and your kneading bowls. The frogs shall come up on you and your people and on all your officials. And the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers, the canals, and the pools, and make frogs come up on the land of Egypt. So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came and covered the land of Egypt. But the magicians did the same by their secret arts, and also brought frogs up on the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron and said, pray to the Lord and take away the frogs from me and my people, and I will let the people go to sacrifice to the Lord. Moses said to Pharaoh, well, kindly tell me when I am to pray for you and your officials and for your people that the frogs may be removed from you and your houses and be left only in the Nile. And he said, the Pharaoh said, tomorrow. And Moses said, as you say, so that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. The frogs shall leave you and your houses and your officials and your people. They shall be left only in the Nile. Then Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord concerning the frogs that he had brought upon Pharaoh. And the Lord did as Moses requested. The frogs died in the houses, the courtyards, and the fields, and they gathered them together in heaps, and the land stank. But when Pharaoh saw that there was a respite, he hardened his heart and would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said. All right, so what do you see? What do you want to lift up? Anything kind of strike you there? Yeah, Stephanie.
I think it's great that Moses showed tremendous faith in saying, when do you want this to happen? Mm. And sort of, so that's what it'll be.
Yeah, exactly. Moses is totally in command, absolutely in command, this kind of really grounding, centering faith inside. He knows what to do. And I think it's really wonderful that Moses is like, well, yeah, when do you want this to happen? And Pharaoh's like, well, let me think about it. You know, maybe not right now, but tomorrow I'll spend one more night with all these frogs in the bed. You know, I mean, it's just like, what? Like, what is this guy? Where it just makes absolutely no sense. But so Moses has got this like, you know, I'll follow the plan. Like, I'm in control this year. And Pharaoh's like, I don't know what to say. Tomorrow, you know. A week from Tuesday, so we're all going to have frog legs for dinner. What else? Anything there? Yeah, Quinn.
Even after the frogs died, there was the cleanup to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I get rid of the plague, but there's still a whole big mess that you are going to have to.
Yeah, so there's a nice spiritual lesson in there too, isn't it? Is like,
kind
yeah,
a semi-relief.
Semi-relief, right? So let's say you really got, you know, whatever you've done is, the consequences for whatever stupid thing you did, you know, this, you get it right, the stupid thing you did, but then the cleanup of this just goes on forever, right? God can, you'll forgive you from your sin, but you don't get a get out of consequences free card, you know? And so in this case, that's what's happening, that you have these piles of dead fish that are stinking in the river, you know, floating up to the top, and then you've got these piles of frogs everywhere, you know, and not just, what's interesting is so that when the magicians this time, when they duplicate the effort, they make twice as many frogs, right? I mean, it's sort of like, again, where did these extra frogs come from? But whatever the magicians do, now there's not only the amount of frogs that Moses originally brought up out of the river, now there's twice as many frogs, one that the magicians brought out too. So they're kind of having this kind of perverse, consequence where now there's, you know, swarms and swarms and swarms of frogs everywhere in the ovens. I mean, it's just kind of wonderful how vivid that is. Like, everywhere you go, you lift up the lid and, oh, there's a frog. So anything else about the frogs? Yeah. And then, yeah, one, two.
I see the frogs coming from Moses as a leap of faith.
Yeah.
And I see Pharaoh as being stubborn. He's deceptive.
Yeah.
And that's what I see in this particular passage.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll go to Marjorie. But I mean, it's just like Sebby said, a lot of faith that he has in Pharaoh. Great. Thanks for bringing up that point that, you know, this is, you know, he's going to over and over again. We're not going to see it every time because I cut some of that out. But pretty much every time he says, oh, make it stop, and I'll let you go. And then Moses makes it stop and he says, oh, well, okay, maybe not anymore. You know, you're going to stay, right? And so he's got, and I think there's also something about that kind of bargaining when do we ever do that? You know, we're like, oh, God, you know, I'll do anything if you, you know, whatever. And then whatever, you know, it is we've prayed for, maybe it happens. and then we say, okay, no, back to normal. You know, forget I ever made that promise or whatever, right? I mean, there's some kind of bargaining quality that I wonder if we know something about.
I was just wondering, why didn't he call on the magicians to get rid of the frogs?
Yeah, great point. You know, there's this kind of lampooning of the whole thing, right? Where it's this kind of, right, the magicians, if they had any sense, they would have made the frogs go away. If they would have had any sense, they would have made the blood water turn back into just water. But they don't. They're completely illogical in how they go about this. And I think, you know, one of the things you can kind of, I think one way to read the story is, you know, there's a god, the Nile is personified as a god. There's kind of an Egyptian god with a frog head, you know, this happens in Pharaoh's bedchamber, so maybe there's kind of a nod to the god of fertility. Like, all of these different kind of creatures or kind of things that happen, you can think about them as kind of God going to war against some other god. Like, this is God going up against the frog god of Egypt and kind of laying the smack down, you know, that kind of a thing. And so there's this kind of element of, you know, where these kind of polytheist Egyptians are being caricatured and they're being lampooned, and there's this kind of monotheistic satire where the God of Israel, the one true God, is bigger than, better than all your frog gods and all your bull gods and all of your, you know, river gods and, you know, everything else. And the God is going up against these kind of natural powers in Egypt that are often personified as gods. And so, you know, they're sort of that. So everyone in Egypt just looks so silly, and the gods are absolutely helpless to make this stop. And as are those who are channeling the power of the gods. All right, plague three. The Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the earth so that it may become gnats throughout the whole land of Egypt. And they did so. Aaron stretched out his hand with his staff and struck the dust of the earth, and gnats came on humans and animals alike. All the dust of the earth turned into gnats throughout the whole land of Egypt. The magicians tried to produce gnats by their secret arts, but they could not. There were gnats on both humans and animals, and the magician said to Pharaoh, this is by the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said. So this time, right, the magicians can't. They haven't learned their lessons. They're still going to try to say, okay, how do we really show that we're as powerful as these guys? I know, we'll make more gnats, you know. But so they try, and then they can't do it. Then they say, okay, wow, okay, we're outmatched. You know, God's the pinky of God. It's, you know, strong. Anything you want to talk about in this plague? A little shorter excerpt, but all right. Plague number four. The Lord said to Moses, rise early in the morning and present yourself before Pharaoh as he goes out to the water. Did you notice, we saw Pharaoh go out into the water the first time, right? So there's some of the settings of these, they're kind of they're paralleled. So kind of notice where the action happens too. We'll talk about that in a bit. So go out, go before Pharaoh by the river and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go so they may worship me. For if you will not let my people go, I will send swarms of flies on you, your officials and your people, and into your houses, and the houses of the Egyptians shall be filled with swarms of flies. So also the land where they live. But on that day, I will set apart the land of Goshen where my people live, so that no swarms of flies shall be there, that you may know that I, the Lord, am in this land. Thus I will make a distinction between my people and your people. This sign shall appear tomorrow. And the Lord did so, and great swarms of flies came into the house of Pharaoh and into his officials' houses, and in all of Egypt the land was ruined because of the flies. Now, this is a good example of, you know, when we think of flies, we actually don't know how to translate this word. This is kind of some untranslatable word, and one commentator has translated it just the horde. There's this kind of horde of buzzing something we don't really know. We think it's probably not locust, because locusts come later in the plague cycle, but a lot of these words, we're not exactly 100% sure what they are. So it's something bad that comes and seems to be completely overwhelming and annoying and ruinous, but flies is as good of a guess as the most translators have. But anything about this one? Yeah, in front.
It actually seems to make perfect sense, because first you have the stinky water, then you have the frogs, the fish, then you have the frogs. It's not a surprise that there's lots of flies.
Exactly, yeah. So hold that in your thoughts. See if So you that we're going to talk about that in just a little bit, but see if you can see any kind of, there's this kind of natural escalation in addition, right? Things are getting a little bit more, a little worse, a little more annoying, a little more, the consequences of these, the fallout from these plagues is getting a little more difficult. And there is this kind of logic to how these plagues unfold. So see if you can kind of keep making that move and see how they build upon one another in a kind of logical way. Diane, were you going to jump in?
Where are the magicians?
That's a great question. I might have cut them out, but I don't. Maybe they just don't make an appearance anymore. I don't remember. Sorry about that. I was edit happy. All right. Anything else about the horde, the flies?
No magicians in the fourth place.
They're not. Okay. Good. At some point, they kind of, you know, they're in and out. All right. Let's see. Number five. What do we got? The Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, the God of Hebrews, let my people go so that they may worship me. For if you refuse to let them go and still hold them, the hand of the Lord will strike with a deadly pestilence your livestock in the field, the horses, the donkeys, the camels, the herds, and the flocks. But the Lord will make a distinction between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt, so that nothing shall die of all that belongs to the Israelites. The Lord set a time, saying, tomorrow the Lord will do this thing in the land. And on the next day, the Lord did so. All the livestock of the Egyptians died, but of the livestock of the Israelites, not one died. Pharaoh inquired and found that not one of the livestock of the Israelites was dead, but the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, and he would not let the people go. All right, what do you think about this one? Yep, down the front, Maggie.
I'm surprised that the Israelites own their own.
Sure. Okay.
That they're able to own property even though they're slaves.
Yeah, that they've got there's kind of the subsistence, yeah. You know, care for themselves. Yeah. One thing about the camels, they probably didn't really have camels yet at this time in history, so it's a little bit of an anachronism thrown in there. But were you wanting to jump in over here?
Well, I just wanted to say there's a sort of theatrical quality to this.
Yeah.
And it, you know, slowly building up, we know something's going to happen, but this and Pharaoh has to be. Well, he is depicted as really stupid.
Yeah, exactly. And really stupid, I mean, is more than evil, right? I mean, it's sort of in some ways, like you get this sense of this person is like grossly evil, right? I mean, murdering all these babies, just like no care for that. So there's this cruelty, but at the same time, this utter stupidity, holding in one hand just cruelness and then stupidity in a way that maybe you know, and maybe we can think of people that also embody both of those qualities. But the point being, like, there's this kind of where, I didn't say anything. I just, like, you know, use your imagination. But in a way that I think there's this kind of, you know, I think there's something there, how you depict that stylization of this character as just so stupid that it's stupid. To persist in that kind of cruelty, you've just got to be stupid to do it. Like, it's not, it's the stupidity of evil at this level. Like, yeah, Mario, do you want to jump in?
It's also, to me at least, reading almost like a children's story.
Yeah, okay.
That kind of repetition, that kind of the characters, mm-hmm. and it's, I can imagine someone reading it or saying it to someone in that kind of manner.
Yeah, let's go back here. And then I'll say, you know, one of the things that some scholars have said was that, you know, these kind of refrains, these kind of let my people go so they may worship me, and then the kind of the Pharaoh hardened his heart, that there are these kind of the structure of some of these refrains that happen throughout, that possibly this could have been put on as kind of a dramatic liturgical kind of play, like as a part of a worship celebration or as a festival. There might have been these kind of dramatic reenactments of the story, so that's why there's some of the repetition built in and a lot of this kind of fun drama. So, yeah.
I thought about Pharaoh and his behavior. And a lot of it started with the sacrifice of the Jewish people wanted to sacrifice in the wilderness. And the animals, some of the animals that they wanted to sacrifice was sacred to the Egyptians.
Okay, sure.
So that may have been part of why Pharaoh was so stubborn, mm-hmm. because he was passionate about his religion just as much as the Jewish people were passionate about theirs.
So again, there's that kind of bringing us back to, there's something, you know, as we read this, you know, there's this kind of theological depth to it, that this is God, there's this kind of one faith tradition versus another, and there's some antagonism with that. Let's move on, and then, let's see, we're wrapping it up on the plagues. Okay, sixth plague. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, take handfuls of soot from the kiln, and let Moses throw it in the air in the sight of Pharaoh. It shall become fine dust all over the land of Egypt, and shall cause festering boils on humans and animals throughout the whole land of Egypt. So they took soot from the kiln and stood before Pharaoh, and Moses threw it in the air, and it caused festering boils on humans and animals. The magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils, for the boils afflicted the magicians as well as all the Egyptians. But the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses. So this one, right, we see these magicians now. They are rendered helpless. They not only can they not perform the miracle, they can't even get out of bed. They are absolutely afflicted too, and they are powerless before this great mighty power. Anything about these boils you want to talk about? Yeah, Stephanie?
I'm not sure about this, but I think in the fourth and fifth plague, Moses and Aaron did not actually perform anything.
Yeah, good.
Neither did the magicians. They weren't in there.
God just sort of did it.
Did it. And now Moses and Aaron are back. The magicians come back into the story, even though they're not able to do anything.
Great observation. Yeah, some of these plagues, Moses and Aaron are the active agents. God's sort of working through them where they kind of have to take their staff or do something or say something. But again, like we saw, Stephanie mentioned, sometimes God just sort of does it. And Moses and Aaron are kind of not really involved with it whatsoever, kind of maybe bystanding to this kind of thing that's happening from outside of them. So John over here, and then.
Why would Pharaoh need help from the Lord to have his heart hardened?
Yeah, we did that last week. So go back and rewind. We don't have time for that hard mystery. But the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. If you're interested in that, go back and watch last week's.
You know, this whole thing of the Lord punishing a certain group. Mm-hmm. Is like a boil on my soul.
Yeah.
It's God doesn't do that.
I was waiting for someone to bring us there. Okay, yeah.
I just don't, and I think that, you know, in my own life, I had a child who died of AIDS, and there were lots of people who said, that was God's punishment. That's where mm-hmm. this comes from.
Right, I mean, think about all the poor Egyptians, right, who had no relationship to Pharaoh whatsoever. They were probably poor. They were doing the best they can. They didn't know anything about all of this kind of Moses and Aaron stuff. And they're, you know, they're coming down sick. They've got these nasty boils, and for no cause, right? They did nothing. And so the very idea of divine punishment in this story, there is something that I think might offend our moral sensibilities a little bit, right? There's a kind of unjustifiable, maybe unjust, kind of punishment that's meted out to these undeserving characters. Right. Right. So one of the things we're going to do at the end is kind of see if we can make sense of the story in another way. Think about the idea of judgment, punishment, these plagues as something beyond God going zap. Because I kind of chafe against that. I also kind of think, that doesn't seem like God. I mean, that's not really the God I worship. And, you know, I want to believe that the story is actually not inviting us to think about God in that way, but rather in a little more complicated way. So thank you for teeing that up. I think it's really important. Patrick, do you want to jump in?
Kind of how the world works. If we have like selfish evil leaders and they invite disaster on our nation, that's kind of how it is.
Right? Yeah, and so great point that in some ways that what we have to do is, and I think we'll do a little bit at the end, but to God sort of getting the blame for this, I mean, really, there's this kind of movement to say, well, really these things are happening because of Pharaoh, and that there's a relationship between cause and effect, kind of sin and consequence here, that God, is God directly involved with that, saying, because you did X, I'm going to strike you with Y, or is it just that when people sin, things just happen, right? You can think, you know, if you do, who knows what sins you all have committed. So I don't want to name an offensive example. But, say you rob a bank. Probably don't have a lot of bank robbers in this room. Say you rob a bank and you're walking out, you know, with your bags of, you know, cash. And the police officers say, stop right there. And you go, okay, you know, and then you go to jail. Did God say, okay, you know, God said, okay, you know, God dialed 911 and said, you know, get these officers there, and God kind of beamed them down, or is it just, if you rob a bank, you're going to jail. That's just what happens. And there's this kind of sense of when, you know, you can read this story less literally and at the kind of level of just how we think about morality, that when leaders, when anybody do stupid, sinful things, there are consequences. And grace doesn't mean there are no consequences, right? Like if you, there are some really you know, when there's betrayal in a relationship, right? There can be rebuilding of that, but there's still, you still have to live with the reality of past. We all have those things in our lives and our families, mistakes we've made, where even though there's forgiveness, that doesn't mean that we don't really live with the consequences. And I think part of this story sets us up with that, that there is, the consequences are just built into the world, and that's kind of what we mean by a moral order in the world. Seventh plague. Tomorrow at this time I will cause the heaviest hail to fall that has ever fallen in Egypt from the day it was founded until now. So we're getting this kind of hyperbolic, kind of the worst plague ever, the biggest hailstorm ever. There's never been, you know, once in a thousand year, you know, hailstorm kind of a thing. Send therefore and have your livestock and everything you have in the open fields brought to a secure place. Every human or animal that is in the open field and is not brought under shelter will die when the hail comes down upon them. Those officials of Pharaoh who feared the word of the Lord hurried their slaves and livestock off to a secure place. Those who did not regard the word of the Lord left their slaves and livestock in the open field. The Lord said to Pharaoh, stretch out your hand toward heaven so the hail may fall on the whole land of Egypt, on humans and animals and all the plants of the field in the land of Egypt. So Moses stretched out his staff toward heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and fire came down on the earth. And the Lord rained hail on the land of Egypt, and there was hail with fire flashing continually in the midst of it, such heavy hail as there had never fallen in the land of Egypt since it had become a nation. The hail struck down everything that was in the open field throughout all the land of Egypt, both human and animal. The hail also struck down all the plants of the field and shattered every tree in the field. Only in the land of Goshen, where the Israelites were, there was no hail. Okay, so something's really different about this one, right? There's kind of this advance warning to the Egyptians, and the Egyptians have the opportunity to kind of take heed of this and say, okay, we've seen this one before. You know, we're getting everything out of the fields. We're locking the livestock up. And some of them do that, right? So there is this kind of sense of there is a responsiveness to the, you know, the whole, you know, kind of great mass of innocent Egyptians, and some really do take heed of this warning, but we hadn't seen that kind of warning, right? You know, Pharaoh may get the warning, but the people this time are kind of, Pharaoh's bypassed, and the people get to kind of stave off the stupidity of their leader in this one plague. Let me make us kind of go forward a little bit. Okay, so then stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt so that the locusts may come upon it and eat every plant in the land, all that the hail has left. So this great image, right? The hail comes, all the plants are ruined, the crops are ruined, the trees are ruined, everything's laying on the ground. And so just to make sure that the people can't salvage any of that, then comes the horde. Then these locusts come, Moses stretched out his staff, the Lord brought an east wind upon the land all that day and all that night. When morning came, the east wind had brought the locusts. The locusts came upon all the land of Egypt and settled on the whole country of Egypt, such a dense swarm of locusts as had never been before nor ever shall be again. They covered the surface of the whole land so that the land was black, and they ate all the plants in the land and all the fruit of the trees that the hail had left. Nothing green was left, no tree, no plant in the field, all the land of Egypt. This is turning into like a Dr. Seuss book, right? This is the Lorax. This is after they're stripping the trees bare, and now there's just, this is kind of this moonscape left in Egypt, nothing. I mean, one thing to kind of note is this kind of east wind that comes through. Notice that. We're going to see that again. But the Israelites, this was probably written, you know, after a time when they'd long after they've left Egypt, because they're thinking, who's ever writing this about an east wind coming in from, you know, think about Israel on the map, the wind coming in from the east, and then the west wind from the sea is going to blow the locusts out. In Egypt, that's not how it works, right? The wind would blow from the south, up from the Sudan, and so their geography is a little off here. To bring locusts up into Egypt would be a south wind bringing them up that way. That's just the way the wind patterns work, evidently. And so they're writing from the perspective of being in the promised land, not being in Egypt. But so locusts come, things are bad. Never seen anything like this before. And then the last one. Stretch out your hand toward heaven so there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, a darkness that can be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven. There was dense darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. People could not see one another, and for 3 days they could not move where they were, for the Israelites, but the Israelites had light where they lived. Okay, really quick, some ways to think about how these plagues kind of fit together. You can think about them by the theme of them. So there's two that happen at the Nile, water to blood and the frogs. There's two that involve insects. There's two that involve these kind of diseases. There's two that involve kind of the hail and locust, the damage to the crops more broadly. And there's these kind of this uncreation, right? Think of the darkness and the death. Another way to think about it is where they happen. I mentioned the setting. There's some repetitions. Some of them happen outside in the morning, you know, where Pharaoh's going by the river. Some of them happen at the palace, like kind of in Pharaoh's house. Some of them happen without Pharaoh at all. And they just sort of, God just sort of does it, as Stephanie had noted. And see how they kind of rotate, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So there's this kind of careful interweaving of plagues that kind of follow a very stylized setting there. But they, so there's something artful about this, there's something literary, how it's organized. This is how I kind of like to organize them. This is from a this is a commentator that I like, and talks about how what the plagues seem to do. It demonstrates God's power over the water. The rod becomes a snake. I'm putting that one in for good measure. You know, the sea dragon we talked about. Water into blood in the frogs. Power over the land. These gnats are brought forth from the dust of the earth. The flies, all the land was ruined by the flies. The pestilence on the cattle, the boils on the cattle and the people. Power over the sky. The hail comes, the locusts kind of come in from the east wind and the darkness, all the light in the sky goes out. There's this kind of sense that the whole creation, the power of God that's kind of built into the created order, is revolting against Pharaoh and all of Egypt. The whole creation is involved with this somehow. And what I want you to see is, remember from the first week when we talked about how the Israelites were fruitful and they multiplied, grew exceedingly strong, the land was filled with them. There was this kind of like proliferation of Israelites. And this kind of is in direct fulfillment of the blessing, the promise in Genesis 1, where God said, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it. So there's this kind of creational theme. Israel represents the goodness of creation, the goodness of God's blessing for life in the world. That's sort of what they stand in for in the story. And when Pharaoh threatens the Israelites, it's not just that he's threatening them and he's oppressing them, but in some way to oppress these people is to act against kind of the created moral order itself. In seeking to cut short the fruitfulness of the Israelites, Pharaoh is kind of broadly symbolic of everything that's anti-life, anti-blessing, and anti-creation. And so the payoff of this, why I think is important, it's probably not helpful to see these plagues as natural historical occurrences, you know, but their sequencing does have a naturalness to it, right? So I was getting into, my partner and I got into a discussion where he, you know, you watch something on the, you know, History Channel where it's like, oh, there might have been this volcano that set off a real kind of explode, you know, kind of an eruption, and that's where the ash came from in the one plague, and I think that's nonsense. I mean, you know, these are so stylized. To think about them as actual historical events is probably not helpful, but as was noted, there is something about them that kind of makes sense, right? The water's poisoned, so the fish die. The frogs jump ship, they leave for land, and they die. There's piles of rotting carcasses, so the insects come, and they're swarming around the carcasses. Then there are these diseases that break out on the animals, then on the humans, and then finally, at the end of this, there's death, right? There's this kind of naturalness to the story that invites us to see this is kind of how the world works, right? This is actually kind of, we can imagine this, we can imagine a catastrophe like this happening, and I think in our time, we actually are experiencing a catastrophe like this happening, right? This is a story about ecological disaster. Whatever else it is going on in this story, the creation is going berserk, right? Because of human sin, the creation is kind of an open revolt. And so think about God's judgment this way, as the interplay of Pharaoh's sins and its consequences. God's not putting a finger into it and saying, zap. It's that sin has consequences. We saw how the Pharaoh abused the creation, how he abused the creatures, right? Abused the people. And when humans abuse one another and abuse the world responds in ways to protect itself that humans probably aren't going to like, right? The river, the water is going to rise. They're all going to be underwater. You know, we know this story now. This story in some ways makes more sense in our time than it ever has before. Abuse of people in the land pushes life to its limits. There's a moral order here, right? Created by God for the sake of justice and well-being in the world. And there's this symbiosis between the human and the non-human world, right? So when people sin, the non-people kind of part of creation, they suffer because of it. They're all wrapped up in tandem with each other. the entire created order is caught up in the struggle here, right? Every single thing. The violence of the plagues reflects the world devolving. The creation is reverting to chaos, right? The death of plants and animals, the sky almost falling in with this hail, light being kind of absorbed back into the pre-let there be darkness. It's almost like in this plague, Genesis 1, the creation story is rewinding itself. And the whole world is kind of getting uncreated and reverting back to the state before God gave it order. I mean, I think that's one really compelling way to think about this story. The non-human world, right, experiences the devastating fallout of human sin. So did you notice how the trees are shattered, right? All the crops are destroyed. The animals are destroyed, right? The effects of Pharaoh's sin and cruelty and right, his greed, a lot of what was motivating him at the beginning was just greed for more and more and more and more. You know, everything around these human beings suffer. It's not just them, right? We look in on it, we say, oh, these poor Egyptians, you know, are they so innocent? You know, what did they do? But I think somebody needs to say, what about the natural world, right? What about every other living thing in this world that didn't do a darn thing, but because of the way human beings live in it, this is all happening. Human suffering results in this story from the environmental destruction that itself results from human sin. I think that's a really clear point in the story that needs to be taken into consideration in our time, especially. So anything you want to say about that? Diane, and then down in front. That was a quick hand up. Yeah.
As someone who is of uncertain faith, I've got to let you know, this is the most devastating thing I have listened to. It's just incomprehensible to me that this is written in a way that expects people like me who are looking for faith to know that there are subtleties. To me, it's a completely vengeful, ugly, and no matter how much it is contorted to now say it's an ecological history lesson for us. No, this to me, no wonder I feel that there is such division in the world. Yeah. If people read this and see this vengeful, I think it's awful.
Yeah,
thanks, I'm so sorry. I'm the only one.
No, I don't think you're the only one. And I think that's part of what I'm doing here is trying to say, okay, is there any way to salvage this, right? For somebody who kind of agrees with you that there's something in here that's just really problematic. And so my offering to you is to think about this as a warning, as the Bible's way of warning us and saying, look, this is really what will happen. Not that God wants this to happen, not that this has to happen, but that when you treat people like this, when you treat the world like this, this is just what will happen. It's a parable about the way that sin against the world kind of destroys the world. And that the lesson is, this is a powerful moral parable of don't be like this. Don't do this, right? It's happened before. We don't have to destroy the world. We can see what that looks like, right? There's these kind of stories of massive destruction in the Hebrew Bible that I think they invite us to think about how to be cautious and gentle and good stewards of the world. Now, Diane, I hear you. Not everyone's going to buy that. You know, and you don't have to. You know, I don't want to sell you something you don't need. But I think part of living with these stories, I mean, other people, I think, would find that point and would say, well, I don't think everyone also is troubled that way. I mean, I am, Diane is. I don't know that everyone else is. I think other people can zoom in different places and aren't even bothered at all. They're sort of like, well, it's a story, you know, and are not thinking the way that you are. So to honor the whole of all of our thinking is important. But Diane, I think that point is really important, and I hear you. I really hear you. I think we have time for maybe one or two more. Yeah, down in front.
Yes, and I think an important point to make, we were talking earlier about innocent people suffering because of the Pharaoh. This is the way it works. Human sin, everybody is going to suffer from human sin, not just the person who committed it. We live together.
Yeah.
And
in the world.
In the world. And there are innocent bystanders always.
Yeah, and so maybe it's helpful to say...
Even people who have tried to, who try to be ecologically responsible, they still, if there are not enough people cooperating in this, everybody's going to suffer.
Yeah, I think about, maybe, let me be more clear on that point, Maggie, you kind of made me think, the difference between this being prescriptive and being descriptive, right? I think a lot of times we read the Bible, we think, okay, I have to find a message for me, for my life, and this tells us something about God doesn't, you know, God is mean, or, you know, and I need to behave or something, you know, or we look to the Bible and we expect it to just speak to us in a way that do this, don't do that. I think this is more descriptive than prescriptive, where it's saying, this is how the world works. This isn't God. This is just baked into the world. The world is going to struggle for equilibrium and homeostasis. And as humans kind of work against it, and humans work against kind of violently against other humans, there is going to be pushback. The world's going to push back against you. Other human beings are going to push back against you. This is just how the world is. And this is profoundly moral. And it's profoundly spiritual, how we live in the world such that we don't make the world revolt against human existence, right? That this is describing a truth about how the world works, not prescribing what's going to happen to us because God's getting mad. You know, I think you can read it like that. I think you can read it like that, but I think not reading it literally and just seeing it as this is just how the world is, and God is... And why is the world like that? I mean, the world's going to outlast us, you know? Like, we might do ourselves in, but, you know, eventually, right, the algae are going to, you know, I mean, the bacteria are going to be there, you know? The world is going to take care of itself, maybe, hopefully. Us, maybe not. You know, not the Egyptians, they're all in the sea, right? But Egypt is going to start growing again on the banks of the Nile. All the Egyptians are dead, but Egypt is going to become fruitful once again. So I think there's a warning, not a threat, if that makes sense. And I think, what's that?
Can we get them across now?
Yeah, so I think we're at time. Mario's going to take us upstairs. But so thank you all. And I'll just say one thing to note about that when they're crossing the Red Sea, I just wanted to show that there's this east wind, again, that drives the waters apart. There is a sense in which even the Red Sea crossing where Moses kind of does this, you know, the story describes it as, well, Moses did, you know, did this, right? But really, there was this wind that did it. So the world is, again, involved in the kind of liberation of people in the world. That it's not just that God, working through Moses, says, okay, you're all saved, you're out of here, you know, you're on the other side of it now. There is this sense that the creation is seeking its own good and its own flourishing and kind of is working in tandem with God to help liberation happen in the world and for all the people of the world. So I like that image a lot of the winds blowing the water. And so it's not just Moses, it's not just God, but the world is kind of seeking welfare and justice for itself and for the people of the world. So, all right, we're over time. You got to go upstairs. This is a big Sunday.